This is Spencer King, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiologists' extended learning series featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You're about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, you will have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access to your mobile device. And each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/AXL. Next, Rob Schwartz is joined by Michael Reardon, who is Chair of Cardiovascular Research with the Department of Cardiovascular Surgery and Professor of Cardiovascular Surgery at Houston Methodist Cornell Medical College. They cover self-expanding transcatheter or surgical aortic valve replacement in patients at low risk of surgical mortality.
Welcome to AXL, Mike.
Well, thank you, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a bit about the trial. What was the history? This obviously TAVR took over the clinical world. How did this occur, and what were the questions that were really intended to be asked with this one?
As Dr. Bromwell pointed out yesterday, symptomatic severe stenosis is a death sentence without aortic valve replacement. For years, surgery was our only option, but a third to two-thirds of people never got surgery because they were too sick. So we came up with this transcatheter, less invasive way of doing it. When we started, the FDA said you can do people that are not surgical candidates or people that are high risk. High risk was defined as a mortality of 10% or more, and that was about 8% of what we were operating on. And we found out in our trial, high risk, that for endpoint of all-cause mortality, TAVR was actually superior to surgery at 1 year and 2 years. By 5 years, it's equal. Then they said, okay, you can move to intermediate risk, which is defined as 3 to 10%, and it's about 12% of what we're operating on. And we found that TAVR for our primary endpoint of all-cause mortality or disabling strokes was non-inferior to surgery. So finally, they said, you guys can move to low risk. And that's defined as a predicted operative mortality of less than 3%. We ran that trial, and we found that for our primary endpoint of all-cause mortality or disabling stroke, the TAVR was not inferior at 2 years, but it was superior for things such as safety at 30 days, and if you added at 1 year hospitalization to all-cause mortality and disabling strokes, it was superior by that metric too.
So with your surgeon's hat on, did you have any trepidation or any concern about this? Were you pretty comfortable the TAVR technique was mature enough to do this, to move into a truly lower risk group, or was this something that was a bit of concern?
We should probably thank the FDA for the way they asked us to do this. Yes. When we started with high risk in people that I'm really not anxious to operate on, and I got comfortable with the valve, and sure enough, it didn't look too bad. Then we went to intermediate risk, where we really would like to operate on a little bit more, but now my comfort has grown, and by the end of the intermediate risk, I had great comfort. I had real trust in this valve. By the time we got to low risk, it looked good. Now, it's interesting that if we'd run this trial 5 years ago, we probably didn't have the procedural expertise to have beat surgery. The procedure has grown in leaps and bounds. And of course, if we run it 5 years from now, I think we'd beat surgery by even more.
Very interesting. Summarize the trial for us. Obviously, two valves, good results with both.
This is the self-expanding superannular valve. And we were recruiting low-risk patients. And they're randomized one-to-one between surgery and TAVR. There's going to be a leaflet thickening and immobility CT substudy that the FDA wanted, but we'll get to that when the endpoint is there. We randomized 438 patients. There was some fallout from there. And by the time we get to our as treated, our analysis group, there's a little over 800 patients kind of in each arm. So there's about 1,400 patients that we're analyzing. We picked the primary endpoint of all-cause mortality or disabling stroke because this is a low-risk population. We want an objective, impactful endpoint. We chose 2 years because, again, it's low risk. We chose a Bayesian analysis so we could get it out a little bit faster than that. But we also looked at some hierarchical power secondary endpoints where TAVR came out superior for EOA, mean gradient, and KCCQ. And then we looked at some safety endpoints, which was superior at 30 days. So TAVR really turned out to be really good in this and, quite frankly, beat surgery. Now, what's interesting in our trial and the partner trial is the surgical data was absolutely superb. You could hardly match the surgical data. It was a tremendously strong comparator group, and yet TAVR still did better.
So given the great results here, what are the safety signals that are remaining then? Or are there any that the average cardiologist needs to be concerned about in looking at these patients as they come back from the cath lab?
for the average cardiologist that refers this patient, you're going to notice a couple of things. We do the procedure. They go to the recovery room. They go to the floor. When you make rounds on that, even they're going to be sitting in a chair asking when they can go home. They're going to be in the hospital on an average from our trial about 2 days. In 1 week, they're going to be back to normal activity. In a month, their quality of life has improved markedly. But there's some things that are going to concern you from the trial. One is, in this trial, pacemakers. Now, it's dropped from our intermediate trial from 25% to 17%. But I'll point out that that is a procedural thing. It has to do with implanting the valve too low and the valve pushing against the conduction tissue. As sites learn to implant higher, they go down. My team's personal pacemaker rate in this trial was 5.6%, which is very competitive for surgery. There was still a little bit of paravalvular leak rate in this trial, but all three generations of our valve were in this trial. The other trial was all third generation. Only 22.3% were our Evolut Pro, which have a wrap on it that's designed to decrease paravalvular leak. And in fact, in its ID trial at 1 year, there was no moderate or severe paravalvular leak. It looked much like a surgical valve. Now, one of the really high points of this trial is our hemodynamics, our effective orifice area, and our mean gradient were superior to surgery at every single time point we tested. And it wasn't every single randomized trial that we did. And in fact, if you look at our EOAs, they're over 2. We know from flow dynamics that until your EO gets 2 or bigger, it's hard to increase your flow with exercise. And as we move to younger people, they're going to want to exercise. So this is going to be important. Gradient and EOA is built into the valve. That's not going to change. The procedural things we can change, we are changing, and they're all getting better.
So it's safe to say at this point you think there may be a class effect, or is this device specific? What's your thought on that as we get better and better in our valve designs?
Well, I think for these two valves at least, we've shown this is a class effect. These two valves, as a class of TAVR valves, are better than surgery. And I think that we've kind of shown that this applies across all risk strata. And I think the artificial risk strata that the FDA gave us to begin with, which has been beneficial in making us work our way through this, is now that we have enough experience with this, is really no longer credible, and we probably ought to evaluate these valves like we would any new surgical valve and say, we don't care about the risk, we're going to go against what the old data is from other valves.
What about longevity of the valves? Any signals there that are telling us yes, no, one way or another?
No, so far, for both of these valves, the durability out to about 7 years looks really good. Now, is that enough durability? No, it's not enough durability. But on the flip side of that, I can name more than 5 surgical valves that have come out after these two valves have less durability, and they get used every day by surgeons without anybody saying, okay, you can't use this because of durability. So I think that right now it looks good. We're going to find out. Both these trials are going to follow patients for 10 years. It's going to give us the best durability data we've ever really collected, not just on TAVR valves, but I think really on surgical valves because it's going to be core lab adjudicated echoes.
Well, given what you're going to set off, which is quite a tidal wave here, I think, what's the role for other cath labs? Is this something that any cath lab can do? What sort of training do we need? Is this something that will be specialized valve centers? Or how are we going to handle this given the large number of patients that likely are going to be coming into the system as a result of your trial results being published?
Well, of course, low risk is 80% of the remaining patients.
Yes.
And not all 80% will be candidates, but probably 50 to 60%. So that's a large number. Surgery is a technical thing. It takes a lot of time to turn a technique. Whereas this is technology. Technology is generally easier to learn. I think most cath labs are going to be able to do this as long as they have a good heart team and good surgeons there, because a surgeon needs to be involved. You really want to do this right. And the ones that aren't doing a lot, if they're smart enough to refer the harder cases on to centers of excellence with more experience, they should produce really good results.
Mike, congratulations on a great trial. Well done. Very well followed up. But can you give us 3 take-home messages for the general cardiology audiences? What should they learn about this as a take-home?
I would tell them that, first of all, if you have a patient that looks like they would be a candidate for a bioprosthetic valve, and for surgeons that generally starts at about age 60 or 65, then we have trials that show that all the way down to low risk, TAVR does as well as or better than surgery, and it's much less invasive, and you go straight home more often, you go straight home sooner, and your quality of life gets better sooner, and your early safety from both a stroke and mortality is better. So that's important. If you send them to a surgeon who does not talk to them about TAVR, you're really not getting a surgeon with true informed consent and decision-making. You should find a surgeon that's willing to do that. And then finally, your patients are going to come in because of social media and because of the internet, and they're going to tell you, hey, doc, I want a TAVR. So look at the broad strokes of this. Understand that this really is good technology and that it is now applicable all the way down to once we get FDA clearance, and we're going to get FDA clearance for this, all the way down to low risk. That doesn't mean everybody, but if you're of a reasonable age and you're a good candidate for a bioprosthetic valve, it needs to be in the conversation.
Well, Mike, once again, congratulations. Very well done study, outstanding results, making a major impact, I think, in the practice, going to change a lot of patients' lives for a good direction. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. This has been a great journey and a lot of fun.
This is Spencer King, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/Axel.